The content of this podcast is for informational purposes only and should not be construed as financial or investment advice. The views and opinions expressed in this podcast are those of the hosts and their guests. They do not necessarily reflect the position of any associated employers or organizations.
Hello, everybody, and welcome to episode number 21 of the Applied MMT podcast. Today, we have another special guest, Derek McDaniel. Derek is a big... what I think to be an MMTer, we'll find out more in the conversation, but who is pretty active on Twitter in the MMT debates that are constantly going on. Derek, I think to kick us off, would love to hear more about your background and maybe how you got into MMT, and we can go from there.
Yeah, so when I was younger, like I was really into academics, like mathematics, and I varied between mathematics and computer science in school, but just due to some personal circumstances, I didn't end up graduating when I initially went to school. And so, like, I was, like, doing different jobs, looking for work, and just trying to understand how the economy functioned and stuff. And, like, one thing I noticed was, like, the kind of jobs that are very productive aren't necessarily the ones that compensate well. Like, I worked briefly as a dishwasher, and I calculated, like, in a couple days I would wash as many dishes as I'd use in 2 years or something like that. And so it's just, like, trying to understand how the economy allocates stuff. And we were talking before we started how a lot of us have a familiarity with Austrian economics. And I read Human Action early on when I was trying to figure out economics. And I liked it. I thought it was an interesting book, but we can get more into that later. But long story short, like I went online and was trying to discuss these things, how, like, personally, I cared more with a job of whether I enjoyed it than how much money I made, just because I felt I could learn to be very frugal and such. And so I thought there would be benefit for me if I could take lower pay and learn different skills. So I was, like, going on Twitter trying to debate, like, minimum wage and stuff. And then just some reason the national debt came up. And someone mentions, like, what was just, like, why is that a problem? And then I was, like, instantly, oh, it's not. And, like, it just hit me instantly, like, this. I didn't know the verbiage at that time, just, like, the scorekeeper analogy. Like, it's just points. It's just, like, an accounting system. It's just a system of allocation. So, like, yeah, I ran into a few MMTers. I know one issue, like, Ellis Winningham talked a lot about was minimum wage. And, like, not just him, but others convinced me, hey, this is actually a good idea given the way the entire labor market functions and relative power and stuff. But, so, yeah, I started out on one path early learning economics, and then I was like, hey, this doesn't make sense. And that's when I sort of got into MMT. So.
Got it. And do you remember what it was that what were the first materials you came across, related to MMT?
Huh? The first materials. So when, like, I don't recall exactly, this was like in the, between like 2012 and 2015, like the deficit myth hadn't come out yet. And like, it was mostly just blogs, I guess. And videos. So I remember one Steve Keen lecture really stuck with me, like, dialectic as a foundation for non-equilibrium monetary economic or something like that. So there was the Steve Keen lecture. It's like 2 or 3 hours long. And then Mosler, obviously, like, I would have to say it was mostly the YouTube lectures at first. And then I started reading more books, and then blogs, and then books and stuff like that.
Got it. I kind of had a similar path into MMT, where I was reading a lot of the, you know, I first started hearing about it on YouTube, and then I started reading the New Economic Perspectives blog. And then I bought Randy Ray's book, the primer, the MMT primer, which I think is great. So today, like where would you say you stand when it comes to MMT? Like, are you?
So I think MMT is substantially correct. Like, I would maybe nitpick with more like presentation or wording rather than the substance of anything. My biggest critique of the way we engage with MMT is that I think we could do better to separate it into independent propositions. Like, we can talk about endogenous money as one proposition that is frankly uncontroversial once when you talk to experts, but it's just ignored. It's crazy how people love their money abstractions, but and so you have endogenous money, then you have the consolidated view of government finance, and then that at least one other part, just Mosler's idea of price anchoring, like the price level is a function of prices paid by government when it spends. So, and like people talk about fiscal theory of the price level, and they compare MMT to that, but like it's, I would call it, at least for price anchoring, I would call it the fiscal bidding theory of the price level. So not so much the amount of the deficit matters, but like how much you're offering when you spend that money will drive the price level. So, yeah, so I agree with MMT. Like, obviously, there's the issue of how to label yourselves. And, like, the whole idea of post-Keynesians, that's sort of confusing because it's not really a well-defined... There's not a single proposition with post-Keynesian economics. It's sort of... came out of this historical just set of arguments that people landed on one side or the other on. So, and there's a lot of disagreement among post-Keynesians themselves, you know. But
Derek, you've brought up a topic. I do like your I don't want to call them amorphous because I think they're definitionally succinct. But your kind of three pockets of ideas, and one of them you brought up was endogenous money, and you've mentioned Steve Keen. So I imagine at this point you've listened quite a few of those Steve Keen lectures that are out there. Which, by the way, if you're listening and you haven't gone back, like probably about starting in 2009, 2010, up until 2015, there is just a trove of great lectures by Warren Mosler, by Steve Keen on YouTube. If you're a YouTube consumer, which it sounds like Derek, you are, if you listen to some of those lectures, then we've probably listened to the exact same stuff. That was a great time period, and really one of the only places you could get MMT stuff if you really wanted to get deep into it. But endogenous money, Steve Keen, just walk us through that idea, and then kind of tell me maybe why you segment that out. I'll tell you what too, just listeners, if endogenous money didn't have so many damn syllables, I would have been Douglas the endogenous money trader, because I think that's maybe even more important causal function of what we see as kind of economics than necessarily, you know, broader MMT. But yeah, tell me a little bit about this endogenous money and kind of where you think people belong or whatever.
The word, it's confusing on two accounts, because the word endogenous and money, they're both the most confusing terms you can think of. So money is just whatever we use to transact, so people can generate their own transaction mediums. That's basically the way I would summarize it succinctly. Like, it's basically credit runs the economy. Like,
Yep.
So, I mean, there's all sorts of aspects to it. Like, even people talk about, I was talking on Twitter today about euro dollar, just there's this term called euro dollars for these foreign credit markets that deal in treasury bonds and other. I'm not a finance person. Like, I don't have enough money to actually trade. I'm just highly fascinated by this stuff. So
yeah. But when dollars make it out of the U.S. and they go into foreign banks, all of a sudden the foreign banks now have the ability to use this now dollar deposit in their bank to essentially be capital it's probably the best way to explain it, to capitalize their own creation of these then new dollars, or these new euro dollars.
Yeah, and I would say the question with interest rates is like, if banks create their own money, then why do they charge interest, kind of thing? Why does anyone charge interest if we're just creating money on the spot? So now this isn't necessarily the way endogenous money is typically described, but I typically describe bank money creation as upgrading from one form of money to another, or from one IOU. So like back in the day, if you watch old Westerns, like people would pay at a bar, like put it on my tab. Like if you try to go to a bar or a grocery store and try to pay with credit, they aren't going to do that for you just because credit works a little different today. But credit used to be very common. Like, and even non-MMTers, like if you follow George Selgin, I'm not sure if I said that correctly, but he's sort of an expert on having multiple different currencies circulating. So when you have like different credit systems, the tendency is for one to dominate that. And then that's how you end up with something called money. When really people are just transacting and using resources.
Yes. Yep. Yep. Have you watched a lot of the Steve Keen lectures and his whole?
Oh yeah.
Okay. Okay.
Yeah, like he has one where he talks about dialectic and just like everything has a foreground and background. Like,
yeah,
a worker is also a consumer. And if you work too much, then you won't have time to consume. Like, it's just a philosophical principle that has surprising economic relevance. And that's sort of one thing that got me thinking, hey, maybe mathematical models aren't in the full picture here. Maybe there's these ideas that sound vague on the surface, but they actually better describe reality.
Yeah. I have more questions down the rate idea, but Ryan or Adam, if you want to come in and jump in and
yeah. Hey, Derek. So I first kind of stumbled on your work. And it caught my eye because of the this idea. You know, we talk a lot about the term structure of prices and how if the Fed is raising rates, it's literally discounting or depreciating future cash flows or future piles of cash, And I know that that sort of goes down your whole rate disparity thing, which I think is your Twitter handle too. So maybe if you could talk a little bit about the concept of rate disparity.
Okay, so it's sort of a pun on words. So in the first sense, it's sort of making fun of equilibrium, right? So if you look at the economy, what's the range of wages people earn in the economy? What's like the lowest wage to the highest?
Probably
wage?
Zero.
Yeah, so you could go zero, but just for the sake of argument, let's start at $7.25. And like, what's highest? What's the highest wage someone would earn?
On a per hour basis, that is a good question.
So, I think once you start thousands of hours, like the most high end lawyer. Thousands of dollars an hour would probably be where people are just start making capital gains and they don't bother paying themselves a wage, right?
Uh-huh. Got it.
So there's probably a 1,000 times factor from the lowest wage to the highest wage in the economy. And
interesting.
Like, this is just a normalized thing, right? It's just like, hey, this is how the economy works. But then if you talk about interest rates, if one financial instrument yields 5% and another yields 3%, then it's like, oh no, no one's going to buy the underperforming asset. Like, so that's one meaning of rate disparity. Like, I mean, that relates to MMT because that MMT helps you be more aware of like inequalities and what actually is happening in the economy and the whole hierarchy.
That's a good way to put it.
Yeah. So basically, and another thing with, so economics, either when there's any difference in returns, they either attribute that to either risk. Like if you lend someone at a higher money at a higher rate, usually that's attributed to risk, right?
Right.
Someone's a riskier investor. The weird thing about risk is you're actually punishing the people who don't default based on their cohort who you think might default. So does that make sense?
Uh-huh.
Anyway, sorry if I'm a little bit all over the map. That's sometimes how my thought process goes.
Yeah. No, that's very interesting. Yeah, no, this is all like novel stuff. I'm just trying to process it all.
Yeah. So, as I was saying, normally when there's a difference in returns, it's either attributed to economic frictions or to risk. But I don't think that's a good way to describe equilibrium. Like, and so I came up with this notion, which I called adaptive equilibrium. Like, if you look, if you go into a mall, into a crowd of people, like, the variation in people's height isn't that big, right? For most adults. Right.
Yeah.
So, but there's no, like, feedback process to make that all converge. It's just, like, there's all these processes where, I don't know if you've heard of like convergent evolution, where two different animals will develop similar solutions to a problem.
Uh-huh. I have not, but
it so like
seems intuitive.
Convergent evolution is like fish and dolphins both have fins, even though one's a mammal and one's a
Got it. Okay.
A fish. Yeah.
So in that case, there may be like sort of a uniformity to rates, even if there's no like feedback process or direct competition, you know?
Interesting. Okay.
So I like whenever I think of an idea, try to think of something new, I try to see if there's like examples of other people have done. And the closest thing with this idea is, I guess there's this, there's some things called, there's a webpage, Resilience Alliance,
okay,
which basically talks about ecological cycles, like there's a growth phase, and there's like exploitation, and then there's like reorganization. So there's all these, we talk about like business cycles and stuff. Where the economy goes through its own cycles. And like in the Austrian perspective, the business cycle is a problem of inventory, right? These businesses build up inventory, but I see it more complex as like you have political cycles, you have cycles in media, technology, like there's just like, it's like the waves of the ocean. Like in the ocean, many different things can affect the how the water moves. Like, you can have earthquakes, you can have, if you're in a harbor, like, the boats in the harbor might affect the water in the proximity, but even something as esoteric as the moon affects the waves in the ocean. So, yeah.
Yeah. That's interesting. And you know what? What's funny is I feel like a lot of times you'll hear people talk about cycles and natural processes and all this sort of thing, and it's almost like it removes like agency, right? It's almost like it's like a very deterministic way of looking at the world, and it's like, oh well, you know, they'll notice some pattern, and then they'll say, well, this is just such and such again, and this is going to happen, and it's inevitable. You know, yeah, it's inevitable that we're going to have a blow up, and it's like
it's very hard to find patterns in processes where there's a lot of interacting forces, right?
Right, and you'll get to, and it's, but it's also like, you know, you don't know necessarily how, like there's power and structures and hierarchies, and you know, you don't necessarily know how people are going to react if they're, you know, if they react one way, then this is the outcome. If they react another way, then you know, this is the likely outcome. And there's just no way to predict that. So, you know, it shouldn't be like the Fed setting rates, or like, you know,
yeah.
Or like Mosler talks about, you know, the Saudis, the crown prince, like, you know, I think I've heard Moses say,
like, in hindsight, things must have happened that way just because they
right did. Right, exactly,
you know, if you play a poker game, one person can have the winning hand, the other person can lose, but it could have easily gone the, like
exactly, yeah it doesn't take into consideration all the potential outcomes, and yeah you're kind of
Recently, there's just been so many debates about counterfactuals with the transient inflation. It's like, well, what would have happened if the Fed hadn't raised rates? And
right.
So
Derek, I know a few times back when I was doing the live stream, you would comment on my various ideas about rates and the impact of rates, and you'd always comment, and I'd be like, I'd nod my head and think, okay, but then you'd comment again, and I'm like, you know, maybe I'm not understanding what he's saying. Maybe I there's something
sometimes
more.
Sometimes I don't understand what I'm saying either.
No, I didn't mean it that way. I meant it more like, no. I think there's something here. But I gotta fully understand, because I don't think we're in major disagreement, but we're definitely saying something different. So tell me your thoughts on you know, rates and the implication of rates, higher rates, lower rates.
Okay.
And to the best of your ability, I know you've been able to hear a lot of what I've thought about tell me in contrast to that. Yeah.
Yeah. I mean, so we talk about leaving the gold standard with MMT a lot, right? So now we're in a fiat money world, central banks buy treasury bonds. So it's like, one thing with that, you can't compare interest rates directly, right? And this is something Brian Romanchuk talks about sometimes. Like, you're always looking at expected rates of inflation, especially when people talk about the Taylor rule.
Uh-huh.
It's hard to compare interest rates when you don't have one fixed unit of account that everyone is operating on. So when you're raising and lowering rates in this fiat money world, it's not so clear that you're directly competing with anyone so much. But sorry, can you restate your question?
Okay, my big thesis has been, Fed raise rates, that makes the future cost of doing business more expensive, but then the Fed is also supplying the additional income to support that higher price structure. And I think you've had, I don't want to call them a critique, but you've certainly commented on that a few times. So, you know, feel free to tell me where I'm right or wrong.
There's a very simple way to think of how rates can cause inflation. So, and this makes sense on a fiat money world, this explanation. So I think of interest rates as just an exchange rate, right? So let's say the Mexican peso, 10 pesos is worth $1. I don't, It might have been that 10 years ago. I have no idea what it's
close enough
today.
Close enough for this example, right? Yeah.
But so yeah. The U.S. dollar is worth more than the peso. Does that mean the U.S. has a stronger currency? No. I mean, obviously, if you understand FX, like, it's the relative movements, right?
Yep. Yep.
So what happens when you are buying a security, when you're offering interest? Basically, so it's 2024 right now. If I want to buy an instrument at a 5% rate, then I will pay $100 today to buy $105 in 1 year. So, basically, on a unit-to-unit basis, that would mean money today is... one unit of money today is worth more than the money you're buying in the future. Like, if you ignore CPI and all those things, like, you're doing the... like, whenever you have a market exchange, you're supposed to be exchanging equal value. So...
yep. Yep.
If you exchange a $2024 for if you exchange $120.24 for $105.25, then on a unit basis, the $2024 is going to be worth more. So, and you can get into like calling it a continuous stock split.
Yeah.
And stuff like that. And what happens with the real rate depends on CPI and all this other stuff, but I would compare that to like purchasing power parity. Like, if you go to a different country, sometimes your money will go further, which is a different concern from the exchange rate. So I like to think of the real rate as sort of analogous to purchasing power parity.
Yep. If I was listening to this, I'd be hitting rewind to make sure I let that last point hit right there. So let me get this restated about the 2024-2025 dollar, because halfway through I'm like, wait, we're in 2024 now, so I think he's going to jump forward to the next year.
Yeah.
All right. So if I'm hearing what you're saying, correct me if I'm wrong here. When I take a $1 unit today, set it aside to get back by purchasing a bond, to get it back by to then have it be 1.05 units a year from today, your argument is what I set aside, I'm literally buying something cheaper. I'm literally buying something of less value than
on a
than
unit basis.
On a unit basis than what I had today.
A very simple example with fruit. If you have apples and oranges, if two apples buys an orange, then which one's more valuable? Right? So if two apples buys an orange, the orange is going to be more valuable.
Yep. Yeah.
So if you have interest, like if the interest rate's 100%, if $1 today buys $2 in a year, then on a unit basis, the dollars next year are less valuable.
Less value. Okay. Okay.
If the market equilibrates across time and not just at each point in time, it's also equilibrating across time. But.
So by raising interest rates, you are mechanically devaluing tomorrow's dollars.
Yeah.
And mechanically increasing today's dollars.
Yeah. So yes. Yeah. When people say, oh, raising interest rates fights inflation, well, if you look at the duration shocks, and this is an argument Colin Roach often makes, he's like, oh, when you increase interest rates, outstanding bonds devalue, which means people have less purchasing power. And so he uses that to generally support the argument that higher rates are disinflationary because bonds lose present value, outstanding treasury bonds. But it's like, okay, they just bought $2025 and now we explicitly devalued them by changing the exchange rate between today's dollars and future dollars. And so we just, in relative terms, we inflated future money.
Well, yeah, I would also argue that, you know, it depends on who we're talking about here, right? You know, as we saw in 2023, following the collapse of Silicon Valley Bank, the Fed and the Treasury came up with this bank term funding program, right? That, you know, they basically would lend, against treasuries at 100 cents in the dollar, regardless of the maturity. In that instance, the Fed is eating the duration, right?
It's so funny to think paying out interest on reserves is deflationary, right?
it's absurd. It's just right. And that's the other thing, is that there is no duration risk with reserves. I was thinking about this last night. It's kind of ridiculous that banks can earn interest and money market on reserves, and money market funds can earn interest on RRP balances. But if we just hold cash, we don't get any interest on that.
Yeah. And
we should be entitled to some interest on the physical cash.
Yeah. You're just taxing people who don't know how to move their money very well, or it's not cost effective for them to worry about optimizing their like, if you only have $10,000 savings, it's not as much worth your time to like try to move your money around between accounts. And yeah.
Yeah, well, that's another good point. And people, especially in the financial world, will kind of say like, okay, Americans are so financially stupid. Like what's the point of even having a checking account where you don't earn any interest on your money? And it's like, well, okay. What is, I think the average or median checking account balance in the United States is like, what, $3,000 or something like that. So, if you're talking about,
yeah, if you have like 5% in there,
yeah, if you're talking about 5% of, and this is before taking into considerations, the monopoly that banks have over the payment system and the direct deposit system and ACH and everything else. But if we just ignore that for a moment and just think about someone with $3,000 in their checking account, okay, 5% of that is what, $150 a year or something. So that's like 12-ish, 13-ish dollars a month that that
like a Netflix subscription.
Exactly. So it's a price.
It's not the way you optimize personal finance. You get a cheaper car, right?
right. Exactly. But again, I think the way to think about it is a price. It's $12 a month to have the convenience of using a checking account and not having, there's actual, a lot of times, to move balances back and forth, like that actually takes some time and effort and stuff. It's like, how much would you actually pay someone to do that for you? At $12 a month, like that kind of seems like a bargain. Like I don't even have to, the funds come into my account, they come out, I don't have to think about it. It costs me $12 a month. That doesn't really, that's actually, in my opinion, not that crazy. It doesn't reflect like, being financially irresponsible or something. It's just a price like anything else.
Yeah.
I gotta say, I do like this idea about somehow our cash spitting out like little bits of cash as set at the right? interest rate or something like that.
Yeah,
like a Harry Potter movie. You know, I can just wave my wand and my cash just spits out some more cash.
One graphic I made is like you take a dollar bill, you cross off the $1 and write 1.05.
How funny would that be actually if like every dollar bill had an expiration on it, right? And you could just take it in the bank and they give you, you know, the 1.05.
It's funny you say that expiration date because
that's...
That's a real proposal by Miles Kimball.
Yeah.
On how to implement
old school banknotes, you know, before we had deposits in this that's basically what banknotes were. Was that you had, you know, you have a maturity and they might be discounted or something like that. When they're initially issued, it's worth 97 cents on the dollar or something. And then,
have notes from different banks like Wells Fargo, Chase, JP Morgan. Like they would accept each other's notes, but only at a discount. Right.
Right. Right. Exactly. Yeah.
Derek, what was the proposal you mentioned? The Miles Kimball proposal?
Oh, yeah. So back in after the great financial crisis, I'm a little hazy on the history, but people were talking about how to get around the zero lower bound because they're like, oh, lowering rates can't stimulate the economy when they're already at zero. And so, Miles Kimball came up with a clever idea for how to charge a deposit fee on cash that progressively increased over time so that you could actually lower rates literally negative. And he did this with the idea that this would be stimulative, and then you could stimulate the economy really fast and then get back to normal and then stop. And under the premise that lower rates are stimulative, I think it was a very clever idea.
And how would that work mechanically? Like there's an expiration date on your dollars, which incentivizes you to spend them?
There was a deposit fee when you would deposit cash that would progressively increase over time. So
I see.
It was the opposite then. It was if you're going to bring your money back into the bank, it's going to be worth less.
Yeah.
Is that how it worked?
Well, that was his proposal for negative rates.
Okay.
I thought it was a really clever proposal. So, but at the same time, I do not agree with the idea that lower rates are actually stimulative, at least not on their own, but.
Interesting. I think I heard Joe Weisenthal mention this recently on the Odd Lots podcast. This idea of like, you know, you pay the bank for, you know, like a deposit, you know, service fee or something because, you know, they're providing a real service or what have you. which is, you know,
that's
very different.
Another negative rate idea. So
yeah,
but I guess the bank isn't necessarily destroying that money, but if they were under that circumstance, if my $100 is going to be worth $95 next year, using the same fruit analogy that you had, today's currency then is, I'm sorry, tomorrow's currency then is worth more than today's currency.
Yeah. If we want to look at negative rates that way, and Mosler has said this before, like if you want to stop inflation in its tracks, at least in terms of unit of account function, you just implement a negative rate policy.
Yeah.
And so, I mean, what would happen with a negative rate policy is your $2 literally becomes just $1. So it nominally eliminates inflation, but it's just like a stock join, right? Is that the correct phrase?
And it's constantly incentivizing people to save their money.
No, it has no incentives. It's just
you don't think. Well, but if I guess my thought would be, if tomorrow's money is going to be worth more than today's money, what's the incentive to?
So you're redenominating everyone's assets.
Okay.
There's no effect on incentives. It's just changing numbers. So, but that would affect contracts, and that gets complicated because, like, if you have contracts denominated in a particular And this is why the Fed is so political, right? Because every decision they make has 100 different ramifications, and people win. It's like when you go to Vegas, you win or lose, but like the Fed's like printing or picking the numbers at the roulette table or something. So,
right.
Yeah.
One other question, because I know this is another thing you've mentioned at least a few times in some of the tweets I've had, and that has to do with my voodoo econometrics.
Right. It's just hard. Like stuff is really hard.
Yeah, you've expressed skepticism, which I appreciate, because whenever I look at Twitter and people post charts, the first thing I think is, well, this is a bunch of nonsense. Like, you know, I mean, there's no way this has any meaning whatsoever. But you've also, I think, said recently, like, okay, maybe Doug's onto something here. Tell me, I mean, just... I am highly, highly skeptical. I know I do a lot of econometrics, but before I ever post anything, I've done a lot of thought, a lot of theory, and a lot of testing of the data to see if it actually conforms to what I think it should. So start with first the skeptical route, so, because everyone should start as a skeptic.
Let me relate this to something else. So I really like computer programming. Like, I was in school. My first major was computer science, and then I switched to mathematics. But and when you're programming a computer, like, debugging is one of the hardest things. And they say there's like a 100x factor between the best engineers and the worst engineers in terms of how productive they are. And mostly because when you write a bad computer program, it's really hard to find why it's wrong. Uh-huh. So you can end up spinning your wheels forever. So when you're doing statistics and tests, like, you're basically testing every possible thesis, or I guess with a regression, you're like, so a lot of these things are very simple, trivial relationships that are being proposed. But in computer programming, it's not just enough to do testing. You have to have a good mental model of the system. And then it's like playing 20 questions, right? If you play 20 questions and you ask the wrong questions, you're going to get nowhere. Like, your methodology can be completely valid, completely good, but unless you're able to narrow in on the issues that will actually give you more information, it's very difficult. So that's sort of where I'm coming from looking at it. Statistics is like, I'm very good at most areas of math, at least at the undergraduate level, whether analysis, calculus, linear algebra. But statistics is my weakest area, right? And in the limit, statistics just becomes machine learning, right?
Yep, yeah.
But what I don't like about machine learning is it's just a black box.
Yep.
Like you play chess against a computer, it can beat anyone in the world, but you don't understand why. It just seems irrational. So,
yeah, right. Absolutely. No, absolutely. Yeah. And keep going. I mean, feel free to kind of fill it out.
My thinking is when there's definite statistical proof of something, like, I'll be the last one to know and I'm okay with that.
Yeah.
But I just like looking at time series and trying to like get us comparatively look at history, like, case studies, things like that. Like, we can talk about Turkey, we can talk about Japan, we can talk about whatever, Venezuela or Argentina right now. Argentina's going to be a crazy case study 15 years from now.
Yeah.
Right?
For better or worse, man. For better or worse.
I mean, to his credit, he's proposing dollarization. He's not proposing to put them on Bitcoin or something like that.
But. Yeah.
So we'll see how that goes. But that's my thinking. When there's the more variables you have, the harder it is to use statistics.
Yep.
And with the economy, there's everything's a variable.
Absolutely. Absolutely. I think that's a very fair critique, and I think that is the absolutely correct way to go about a critique of that, is that at any given time, I mean, just to make like, I'll use a time series that I think approximates what interest rates are actually you know what they are, and then what the actual outcome is of what interest rates are doing, and then I'll overlay the charts like anyone will do, and you know we'll say, look, one causes the other. Of course, no one for whatever reason in finance decides to take the next step of just running some statistical models to see if there's anything there. And then I think the next step is, Derek, what you're saying is, yeah, Doug, that's great that you're taking the next step to run the statistical models, but that could just be one of 100 things that at any given time are impacting what it is that you think that they're impacting. And until you test and come up with counterfactuals of the other 100 things,
forecasting is so, like, it's impressive how good meteorologists actually are, that you can look on your phone and see what the weather's
what's going to happen in the next 5 days.
That's like voodoo, right?
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
But outside of that, like, they have so much data, and they just, it's a closed system. There's not as many variables.
Yep.
But
yep. No,
it's just hard. I just try to look for lower hanging fruit. That's what I say when it comes to methodology. Like, don't make things hard for yourself. Just find the easiest example that will get you the right answer.
I do appreciate the skepticism, and I definitely wanted to be able to bring that up in this conversation, because I think and your explanation was great too. And I think anytime you see data, and I know I do this as well. And so yeah, anytime, I mean, and I'll see this happen too. I'll see two time series that I believe, or you know, some sort of Twitter post, two time series that are not, you know, directly related, and then they have some sort of correlation, and then to go through that step of thorough skepticism of, okay, yeah, there might be a correlation here, but there could be a lot of causal reasons that are both equally impacting the, you know, each time series, and it's actually that unseen variable that's actually the thing that's causing the correlation, as opposed to your own assumption. And for any listeners out there, and Derek, it seems like this is your instinct too, that's the first thing to do. And until you just buy something that tells you, you need to do a ton of work to make sure that that there's
it's just something very hard.
Yeah. Yep. Yep. No. 100% agree. 100% agree. I'm glad, though. I'm glad I've posted a few things with your level of skepticism that at least has piqued your interest. So,
yeah, I mean, when you're trading, you look for what's called signal, like any advantage you can get, even if it's wrong. Sometimes,
yeah, yeah.
If it's right at all, like, just gives you a net expected value gain, then you'll go with it. But if you're trying to make claims on a relationship, that's a little harder.
Let's see. I forgot exactly what I posted the other day that you responded to, but go for it, Ryan.
Did you want to share some thoughts on what's been going on in Turkey?
We talked about that before the call started. So Turkey has been doing crazy things with its interest rates. And so outside of MMT, there's this proposal of what's called, referred to as neo-Fisherism, right? And generally that's, it's called that because it's like a new take on the Fisher equation, that raising rates actually raises inflation. Because if you look at the Fisher equation, just like in the simplest form, what is it? The real rate is equals the nominal rate minus inflation.
Right.
So if you reorganize it to inflation equals, what is it? It's the real, inflation is the nominal rate minus the real rate. So if you increase the nominal rate, just looking at that, it would potentially increase inflation. So a lot of people have toyed with this idea of neo-Fisherism, even more conventional economists. MMT takes a different approach. They're like, okay, what are the who gains and who loses when you raise interest rates? What's the effect of increasing the real rates? But with Turkey, so a lot of people are looking to it to try and like test neo-Fisherism as an idea. And I just don't think it's a good example of that, just because, for one thing, their lira debt is small compared to their GDP. And so what they do with interest rates, because they don't have a lot of lira bonds, if they raise rates, it doesn't dramatically increase their interest payments.
And do their does their central bank pay interest on reserves or something they, similar?
What their central bank has been doing, my recollection isn't perfect, but they've been trying to guarantee, do FX guarantees so that people's savings are protected against FX markets. So it gets complicated. Okay. They abandoned that last year, though. I think last April.
Got it.
So Turkey has a lot of issues. They recently had an election. Erdogan changes policies all the time. And they have foreign debts. They're, like I said before, they're in the middle of Europe, so they're next to Russia. They have to import a lot of stuff, so their balance of trade can really affect inflation. So as a test of neo-Fisherism, it's not great. And it's just really hard to read the data with all these confounding variables. So,
Got it. Okay. But inflation has picked up recently following the rate hikes. Is that correct?
So what gets me about Turkey is people usually economics articles will talk about the year-over-year inflation. And instead of the month over month, but they'll report it like on a frequent basis or like report it right now. Oh, inflation just hit 80%, but it's year over year. So you had 11 months and it's just like the last, I don't know. I just don't like the way people report these numbers. So if you keep track of month over month, you can predict what's going to happen to the year over year in the next month because you'll have 1 month leave. Series and then another month gets added to the series. So if 11 months ago you had really high inflation, then you can predict the year over year inflation is about to drop precipitously. So
yeah, that makes sense.
It just becomes difficult to report. And obviously interest rate policy, the Taylor rule, it's supposed to act with long and variable time lags. I mean, you went over this with your in your podcast with Riddick before, but anyway.
Yeah. Yeah, it's so funny. And to your point, like, you know, when we talk about inflation, generally we're referring to some sort of consumer price index or equivalent or something. And it's like, at the end of the day, that's an index, right? So, I mean, the S&P 500 is also an index. But when it goes up in a month, we don't say, hey, like, you know, stock market inflation was up, you know, 1%, you know, this month or something like that. Even though they're really, I mean, you know, they're kind of politically constructed indexes to sort of, you know, measure, economic measurement or what have you. So, it does make, you know, the communications about inflation confusing because, just because inflation, the rate goes down, that doesn't mean that prices go down necessarily. Yeah. And also, you know, kind of getting back, to what we were talking about earlier and stuff with inflation, it's like, you know, with any of this stuff, we're talking about, you know, prices of real goods and services in an economy, and a CPI growth rate or what have you doesn't really, you know, there are factors that are completely unrelated to, completely unrelated, but not really
exogenous variables.
Yeah, right. Like we had this, you know, this fracking boom, you know, that kind of kicked off in, 2009, 2010, I think was when the technology really started to, get you know, commercialized, and you know, we had basically like a classic sort of credit boom in the form of you know, the high yield junk, you know, or junk bond market financing these massive oil and gas projects in the early 2010s, and you know as these things go, you had a huge boom and then a huge bust, and you know, 2014, 2015, you know, there were and you know, for the years that followed, there were a lot of bankruptcies that took place with you know, companies in the various oil patches in the United States. Now, as a result of that, we had very, very low relative to history oil and gas prices. And it's because we had those low prices is precisely why a lot of these companies went bust, right? Their costs were too high relative to their revenues.
Yeah, commodities are a hell of a market to trade.
right, exactly. But my point is, so we had really, really low and not really much energy inflation or you know, for a long while there, and that would have been, you know, and inflation came in consistently low during that time period, and so that doesn't have anything to do with, you know, the size of the Fed's balance sheet or like any of this other sort of nonsense that we hear all the time. Or like,
I think the idea people are grasping at is you should be able to control the money independently of what happens in the real world, so the two match each other. And the way that was done in the past was trying to control the quantity of the money. But M&T is like, no, you have to control the bid at which it's created rather than just the quantity.
Right. And as a I think what MMT shows too is that the bid, controlling the bid that for it, you know, in the form, for example, of, you know, people's labor. It's like, okay, you have to pay a tax, and you know, this is okay. Well, how do I accumulate the money that's necessary to pay the tax? Well, you know, at that point, then you know, the government is the sort of monopolist price setter, and you know, just names a price for, okay, you know, doing this type of work, you know, we'll get you awarded with you know, the dollars that you know, are needed to meet the taxes. But again, to your point, that's all about prices. And then, you know, once you kind of have established these sort of anchor prices, then, you know, these markets will sort of trade around that, have relative price discovery. But it's sort of like, I mean, you know, it's a unit of account, right? You can't just, you know, someone has to be the arbitrary price setter, so to speak.
Yeah. I think you're exactly right. It's just a very difficult thing to articulate it. I do want to say one more thing about M&T, why people don't seem to get it. For one thing, it's unfortunate MMT is correct being so simple. It's like economics has been sort of stagnated for a long time. And it's like MMT comes along and like, oh, the answer is pretty simple. Just public finance doesn't work the way you think. Or you're creating artificial scarcity. But I think that goes into why people don't understand MMT. It's because there's not an individual benefit to understanding public finance. The way, like, people understand equities markets really well. They understand how to raise capital, do all these things. But for public financing, it's just seen as a source of cost rather than a way to create value. So I think that's where finance sort of goes off. Everyone's focused on making money for themselves, so that they don't bother looking at, hey, we can use public money for public good. Like, even if it doesn't work out in every case, it can, like, not every company that raises capital is going to be successful, but you at least try, and we have sort of created a whole system for doing that. But anyway.
Yeah. The funny thing too, like kind of to that point though, is that like, I mean, the capital markets are some of those highly regulated markets that we have.
Yeah.
Right. I mean, it's, and so.
Would assets be as valuable if they weren't regulated? That's.
Well, the would big they question. Even exist? That's right.
That's, I mean, another good question.
And this is where, you know, like, and I know you've talked before about like property rights and stuff, and it's like, yeah, we have a, you know, you have a public sector that administers property rights and enforces contracts. You know,
yeah, like Bitcoin prides itself on being what's called permissionless, but if you have. No one wants permissionless property, because then you can't enforce property rights.
Exactly. That's, there is no property if it's not legally defined. And so that's something where I think the analogy of like the two fish talking to each other, and you know, one of them talks about the water and the other says, well, what's water, right? And like, you don't even think about,
yeah,
this institutional structure that exists.
It's the graph paper that, yeah, we're drawing the charts on.
One final thing, and you were kind of talking about, that was a really interesting point you made about the you know, the price ranges for wages in an economy. And you know, one thing that I've and kind of reconciling with what I was just talking about, one thing I've thought about is, and I'm not a lawyer, so I'd be interested to talk to someone who's more familiar with contract law, but like, it seems like the way that contracts are written sort of defines the sort of the price level and or the price ranges in an economy. Like, I'm pretty, yeah, sure I can't buy someone's house for a gazillion dollars, because I literally,
there'd be money laundering.
Well, but also just like, that's not a, you know, if that's governed by a contract, it's not, it's a, like, if someone tries to collect,
it would be nullified. It would be challenged.
It's not enforceable, I would think. So
yeah, like I wrote an article once called "The $1 Billion High Five," where you could create a huge tax burden for yourself by charging two people charge each other for a high five. So then anyway, so they're both consuming like $1 billion of goods and services. And then like, if you ever want to be in debt to the IRS, just, I don't know, at a certain point, yeah, it's like, what even makes any of this real, like legal? Like,
right,
if value is subjective, then yeah,
right, and so, but at the end of the day, yeah, you kind of have this market system that's sort of built on a foundation of public law, and then it's like, okay, well, and this is something that I got, you know, we got in a little bit with some Twitter back and forths like last year, where, you know, people will say like, you know, oh, well, banks can just create money. And I would just point out that, you know, banks, you know, operate within financial contracts, right? A bank loan is fundamentally a contract. You need to have some sort of public legal institution that governs that contract. And so, yeah, you know, that has to sort of exist first as like a base layer.
Yeah, if you watch Game of Thrones, they do a great job portraying the political dynamics between the bank and the Lannisters, uh-huh, and everything. Like, the bank is, they act like they're so powerful, but they're just like trying to figure out who's going to come up ahead and not make them mad.
Right, right, right. Yeah, it's all just politics. Hey, have you ever read a book called Scale by Jeffrey West?
No, I can't say that I have.
I think you would really enjoy that book. And we can kind of, just as a closing thought, I think, because, yeah, it just, you know, your points about sort of, well, rates of disparity and you know ecological kind of parallels to economics and stuff. It'll tie in really nicely, and you know, like as just one example, he talks about how you know trees don't grow to the sky because at some point, like the branches would just get too heavy and they would collapse.
Yeah,
and so there are and that's limits.
The redwoods, right?
Yeah, exactly.
They're 1,000 years old. They can get up there.
Right, right, exactly, right. Because and so there are limits to sort of you know these growth rates and stuff and sort of like what we were saying of yeah, no, you can't actually sell something for a bajillion dollars because you know it's not you know it doesn't work within our broader economic, financial, and legal system.
We talk about perpetuities, right?
Right.
So I guess if you're selling a perpetuity, that's going to be an infinite dollar contract. But
yeah.
Anyway, it's been fun chatting with you guys.
Derek,
Derek, thanks for coming
thanks
on.
Thanks for joining us. Derek, I know you have a Medium blog. Derek, D-E-R-E-K, 7mc.medium.com. And then you also have your Twitter account as well, Rate Disparity. I'm sure Adam will put that in the show notes. Anywhere else that you publish or anything like that?
That should be good.
Like, those are the two spots?
Yeah, I've been working on a book. I sort of did a soft release, but it's just a confusing topic, so trying to figure out everything with interest rates.
Okay, it will be on interest rates, and you'll promote that on the Twitter when it finally drops. Okay, well, good. We'll look forward to that. Derek, thanks for coming on, and it was a great conversation, and definitely, like I said, follow him on Twitter, and he has a handful of good posts on the blog as well. So that's all we got for this week on the Applied MMT Podcast. See you next time.